This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. High on the list of coolest animals in our own backyard is the humble turtle. Believe it or not, the U.S. is home to more native turtle species than any other country in the world, 12 of which can be found right here in Connecticut. Chances are you've probably noticed them at one point or another, poking around on land or lurking discreetly near a body of water. These sometimes friendly and sometimes snappy ground huggers are not exactly known for their agility, yet some new Yale research has found that amongst turtles' closest relatives are, well, the birds. That's right, birds. Who knew? Over the next hour, we'll take a look at that research. We will also talk about some of the turtles living in our state. If you have any turtle-related questions or stories of your own, we want to hear from you. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherelive. In fact, tweet us your turtle pictures, whether they're your pets or the ones that you've found in the wild. We'll be talking about turtle conservation and invasive species throughout the course of the hour. Before we get to some of our turtle experts and actually meet some tiny painted turtles that are in the studio with us, I want to welcome in Daniel Field, who's a doctoral candidate in geology and geophysics at Yale and a predoctoral fellow at Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. He joins us by phone from the Smithsonian's Bird Room, and that's actually an apropos place to start this. Daniel, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So first of all, tell us what turtles are exactly, best as we can tell.
Well, it's actually historically been a very difficult question to answer, trying to figure out where turtles fit on the evolutionary tree of other vertebrate animals has actually been pretty tricky. But some of our recent research that was only recently published suggests that turtles are actually most closely related to birds and crocodilians amongst living animals, which was an interesting result that we came to.
So that's a very interesting result. Tell us a bit more about that and how surprised you were by these findings.
Well, to be honest, I was actually quite surprised by the results that we came to. We were essentially following up a study that was published a few years ago that indicated that turtles were most closely related to lizards and snakes among reptiles. But when we took a closer look at those data, it turned out that there were actually some problems with the results that those researchers had come to. When we essentially redid the study, we came to a completely different conclusion, which is actually corroborated by some other data sources as well. And so we feel that the conclusion that turtles are most closely related to birds and crocodilians is actually probably correct.
So give us some things that we might be able to wrap our brains around. I mean, how exactly is a turtle closely related to a bird? We look at a turtle, we look at a bird, and we think, well, that can't be right at all.
Right. Well, the fact that these different groups of reptiles actually look so different has historically been the reason why trying to figure out where turtles do go on the evolutionary tree of life has been so difficult. Because when you think of a turtle, they've got those funny toothless beaks, and they've got those bizarre shells formed by the expansion of their ribs. And the fact that the turtles have this funny body plan means that anatomically there's not a lot to suggest that turtles might be most closely related to birds and crocodilians versus lizards and snakes. And so because anatomy has kind of been agnostic on this problem, we needed to take a look at other sources of data. And so when we actually looked at the genomes of these animals and looked at special molecules called microRNAs, it was when we looked at that deep level of genetic similarity between these animals that we actually did find that although birds and crocodilians are more closely related to each other than either are to turtles, turtles are more closely related to birds and crocodilians than any of those groups are to lizards and snakes.
So what does this change, if anything, about the world of turtle research or reptilian research by and large? Now that you know this, what does this help you uncover?
Well, as you mentioned, turtles are kind of interesting animals. They're just so divergent from other groups of vertebrates. And trying to understand how that amazing body plan that turtles show has come to be is truly an interesting area of research. And in order to come to those sorts of conclusions, the first thing that we need is an accurate evolutionary tree, basically an idea of how these different groups of animals are related to each other. And once we've established that, then we can begin to draw really justified inferences about how that unique anatomy of turtles and other reptiles actually did evolve. So essentially what we did with the study was provide that first really basic framework, providing an idea of how these different organisms are related to each other. And from that, we can kind of down the road try to develop more accurate evolutionary models about how the anatomy of these animals actually evolved.
Daniel Field is a doctoral candidate in geology and geophysics at Yale. He joins us from the Smithsonian Institution's Bird Division today, talking about some new Yale research around turtles. And that's what we're talking about this hour, these amazing reptiles. And we're going to learn more about them and the conservation of turtles throughout the course of this hour. We want you to join us at 860-275-7266. When we think about evolution and we think about things that have evolved over the years, we look back at the dinosaurs, animals that aren't here anymore. Daniel, do we know anything about ancient turtle species that would shock or surprise us? I mean, we always seem to be hearing about some ancient creature that's as big as a house or has a head the size of, a Toyota. Anything new about turtles that we can know about their ancient history?
Yeah, well, the fossil record of the turtle lineage is actually really interesting. And since you mentioned gigantic turtles that lived in the past. In fact, the largest turtle of all time is actually on display in Connecticut at the Yale Peabody Museum of Natural History. And that was a gigantic sea turtle that lived during the age of dinosaurs, an animal called Archelon. And Archelon actually grew to a length of up to 15 feet, which really boggles the mind. This was an absolutely colossal turtle. And of course, there's nothing quite that large around today represented among living turtle diversity. But there are some huge ones. Leatherback sea turtles can grow to over 6 feet in length, but nothing in the modern world comes close to matching this enormous sea turtle called Archelon.
I want to bring into our conversation two turtle experts who've come in and actually brought some turtles with them. Dennis Quinn is an environmental ecologist who specializes in reptile and amphibian research. He is a consultant with the DEEP, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, here in Connecticut. Dennis, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Chuck Landre, who runs the Turtle Conservation Project. He focuses on the protection of Connecticut's turtles and their habitats. Hi, Chuck. Thanks for coming in.
Always good to talk turtle.
I'm wondering if we can just go to you first, Dennis, and ask, sure, when we hear about research like this that sheds new light on what turtles are or maybe are not, as someone who studies them, this must be, interesting new information. What does it tell you?
Absolutely. I mean, any study that comes out with new information is always very exciting. For me, you know, the more that we know about the organism, the more we understand the things that we need to do to protect these species. So, I mean, for me, I'm more of a conservation biologist. You know, I look at the evolutionary side of things to see, you know, potentially where this can take us in the future.
And obviously, Chuck, you are very excited about turtles. You love turtles. So this must be exciting news to you to learn a little bit more about what they are and aren't genetically.
Well, it is. And of course, as a kid, I went down and saw Archelon with its three legs. We're always wondering what took that fourth leg off. But yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, turtles have been around since the dinosaurs said enough is enough. And now, after more than 200 million years, some of them are starting to disappear. So our work, Dennis and mine and many other biologists, is to find a way of keeping these turtles around for a whole lot many more years.
This whole idea of 200 million years, Daniel, is I think something that's really important. It's this kind of amazing link to the past. We don't have the dinosaurs anymore. Many of the species that have been eradicated over the course of just man's time on this planet, we don't have to study anymore. But Daniel, we've got these turtles, and it seems as though we can learn an awful lot about where we came from these creatures that have been around for so long.
Yeah, I actually think that's true. So first and foremost, I'm actually a paleontologist, which is why I'm interested in Archelon. And so that's why I'm actually based in the geology department at Yale. And so I have a really deep interest in the fossil record of these organisms and what that can actually tell us about how these animals are doing today and perhaps how best to conserve them. And when you actually look at the turtle fossil record, some really amazing patterns emerge in that the Cretaceous Paleogene extinction, this event 65 million years ago that took out all of the dinosaurs except for modern birds, turtles basically went through that event relatively unscathed. And so the fact that turtle conservation is a hot area of research now is really alarming. The fact that turtles are beginning to suffer kind of on a human timescale means that these organisms, which really are pretty resilient, are potentially at risk. And I think that has major implications for the conservation of other groups of animals as well.
So, Daniel, I'll ask you this first, but I want our other turtle experts here to weigh in. Something I always wanted to know. So how did they get these shells? How did the shell come to be? You talked about an expansion of the rib cage. What else do we know about the development of the shell, Daniel?
Well, that's actually a great question, and that is a hot area of research right now. And some interesting conclusions are being drawn both from studying the embryology and development of living turtles, but also taking a closer look at some interesting fossil turtle relatives that are just now being looked at in detail. And some recent studies looking at some fossils from the Permian period, which is over 250 million years ago from South Africa, actually show what appears to be the incipient formation of the shell. And when you actually look at the ribs of these organisms, you can kind of, as you look at the evolution of these organisms through time, you can basically track the expansion of the rib cage, this sort of incipient step on the way to developing this sort of fully blown turtle shell, which came later.
It's so interesting because the development of the shell, it's the most distinctive thing about the turtle. You'd think that more animals would do this, right? A hard covering that would protect you from predators. It would make you almost invulnerable if someone was going to come along and try to swoop down from the sky and eat you. What else, Dennis, do we know about the turtle shell?
I mean, I guess I wouldn't be the person to ask about exactly the turtle shell, but I mean, you bring up a great point. I mean, turtles being the only species out there with this protective shell is a huge concern for biologists right now, because we are losing our turtles at such an alarming rate. So having this protection, you know, and then still not being able to survive is of a great concern.
And on top of that, because there are some trade-offs, if you have a shell, how do you breathe? Your rib cage is meant for people to expand. How do you breathe? Turtles have to also evolve a way of breathing, and they do that by either pumping their legs or pumping their throat. How are you going to reproduce? If you're a human who's pregnant, you expand. A turtle has no way of expanding. So somehow they manage to make room inside their body cavities for, in the case of snapping turtles, up to 70 eggs. So it is an utterly amazing evolutionary, truly mystery still.
Daniel Field, before I let you go, what's the next thing you hope to learn about turtles? Because it seems as though they've been confounding scientists for years, and we're learning new things all the time. What's the next thing you want to know?
Well, I think there's a lot of really interesting research to be done on how modern turtles initially came to be. And I think a lot of that research is happening right now. Because we have this sort of emerging evolutionary framework by which we can understand how these different groups of reptiles are interrelated, we can sort of take a fresh look at some of these fossil organisms from the Permian period before the dinosaurs and actually during the Mesozoic when the dinosaurs were around, and actually understand the evolution of these fossil organisms in better detail than we were able to before. And so the exciting thing is that a lot of the actual sources of data, which are these fossils, have already been collected, and so I think what we need to do now is actually go back and take a closer look at some of these great fossil organisms and try to understand the evolution of these unique turtle traits in more detail.
Daniel Field is a doctoral candidate in geology and geophysics at Yale University. He joined us today from the Smithsonian Institution's bird division there. He was talking about some new research into the genetics and evolution of turtles. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me. This was great.
Now, when we come back from our break, we're going to ask our two turtle experts some questions, things like, what do you do when you see a turtle in the road? And we've got some people calling up at 860-275-7266. We're going to find out more about turtle conservation, about invasive species. We're going to ask some big, dumb questions that we always wanted to know about turtles versus tortoises. And we'll try to find out more coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're considering the humble and so interesting turtle on our program. It's the world's most endangered group of vertebrates worldwide, and we're going to be talking about the conservation of the turtle here in the Northeast, and we're going to be taking your calls and questions at 860-275-7266. Whether you have turtles as pets or you have questions about your backyard turtles, We're doing a little turtle talk today with Dennis Quinn, who's an environmental ecologist who specializes in reptile and amphibian research, and Chuck Landry, who runs the Turtle Conservation Project. You can call us again, 860-275-7266. So let's get to some questions. Eric's in Brooklyn. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, thanks for taking my call today.
Yeah, what's up?
I live in the quiet corner of Connecticut, and I have a turtle crossing right up the street. And a couple of times I've gone up, I've seen the little guys crossing the road. I pulled over, I've tried to help them get across, but a couple of times people don't stop, and unfortunately one of them did not make it. And another thing is, how can you tell a snapping turtle from a non-snapping turtle?
Ah, two very good questions. So let's go to the first one first. I know that we're very concerned about turtle conservation, and I know that cars are a big problem for turtles. I don't know who wants to jump in first, but maybe you can address the first question about turtles crossing the road.
Absolutely, yeah. Turtles, you know, crossing the road is a big problem. Basically, what we're seeing, especially this time of year, is you're seeing female turtles leaving their ponds where they reside for most of the season, going to an upland area where they deposit their eggs. So as these different types of habitats are bisected from each other from, you know, structures such as roadways, this causes a major problem for the turtles, because when they're trying to reach their nesting grounds for reproduction and egg deposition, they're getting hit by cars. So trying to save these turtles from the roadways is always something that is a great thing to do. Be careful when you're doing it. You know, you don't want to, you know, put anybody else in danger in the process of trying to do this. But the other thing I always like to stress is that although this is a good thing, it's not a long-term conservation solution. Conservation solutions really need to begin and start in the design phase of projects. So if these roads were not constructed to bisect these habitats, we wouldn't have this problem to begin with. So that's the solution to the problem.
And there are certainly some roadways that are constructed that have turtle crossings underneath, actually grates across the road, and you can see turtles or other animals that are able to move from one side of the road to the other safely.
Absolutely. And I actually worked on a project like that in Brookfield, Connecticut, the bypass Route 7 bypass study, where we put in a very large tunnel. And one of the things about structures like that, although they do work, their placement within the environment or within the landscape is critical to the success of those structures. They are a means to get turtles from one place to the other, but again, they aren't the solution.
So Eric asks a really good question. How do you tell a snapping turtle from a non-snapping turtle? Chuck, you go out there on the road, you see this poor turtle crossing the street, and you want to help the thing along, and you reach down and you pick it up by the sides. I don't know, you can tell me how to pick up a turtle, but if it's a snapping turtle, this has happened to me. They spin around very fast, and they're very, very close to taking off your fingers. So, first of all, how do you tell a snapping turtle from a non-snapping turtle?
Well, snapping turtles are Connecticut's, or even, in fact, the Northeast's largest turtle, but everyone has stories of a snapping turtle the size of a Volkswagen, and in fact, I think the record shell length is about 17 inches. But snapping turtles, unlike any of our other turtles, have a tail which is almost the length of the shell itself. And it is also serrated, almost like a dinosaur tail. So that's one quick way of knowing. They also have a very large head compared to any other turtles. But really, just about any other turtle species we have in Connecticut that is crossing the road and you approach it, they're really pretty mellow. Snapping turtles, they're often females that are crossing the road to lay their eggs. Women in labor tend to be grumpy, so they can be a handful. Do not lift a snapping turtle by the tail. You wouldn't do that any more than you would lift a dog by the tail. You can injure their vertebra. You can just take a very firm hold at the back of their shell and carry them. They will not like it. They will be snapping, but they will not get anywhere near your hands.
So if you're going to pick up a turtle off the road, you're grabbing it sort of from behind, underneath, and you're picking it up by its shell, I assume, unless it's a snapping turtle trying to get at you, it's going to probably go inside its shell and not give you too much of a problem, right?
In most cases, a turtle will retreat to its shell for protection. Snapping turtles usually do not do that. They are, you know, they're also a very large species. So, I mean, I would advise people to be very cautious when shuffling snapping turtles across the road, because, you know, one way to tell if it's a snapping turtle is to check how many fingers you have after you move it.
That's right.
But you got to be very careful with the snapping turtles. And then the smaller turtles, you just pick them up, cradle them in both of your hands, and walk them in the direction that the turtle was walking to cross the road.
If you have turtle questions for us, 860-275-7266, or email wherewelive@wnpr.org. We're also taking some of your tweets with pictures of turtles, maybe in your own backyard, at Where We Live. Let's go to John in Burlington. Hi there, John. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, not too bad.
I want to take advantage of you having the Connecticut turtle expert there. two turtles I used to see, I know are a little bit endangered in this state. I used to see quite a bit up until about 10 years ago. I haven't seen any since around my house. Was box turtles and wood turtles. And what's the status of those currently?
Okay, so box turtles and wood turtles. First of all, a great question, John. Thank you very much.
Both the box turtle and the wood turtle are a species of special concern here in Connecticut, so their numbers are declining. In fact, they're declining over the majority of each of those species ranges across the country. The reason they're declining is primarily due to a few simple things. One we already touched upon, which is roadways. So as we lose our females, we're going to lose the potential ability for individuals to recruit back into the population, but also habitat destruction directly. So as we continue to chop down our state's forests and, you know, degrade habitats that are required for these species, their numbers are going to continue to decline and decline rapidly.
And what is the specific type of habitat that they need that is being decimated?
Right. I mean, there is no single answer to that. These turtles tend to use a mosaic of habitats. In the winter times, they're hibernating in forest. In the spring times, they come down into early successional fields in shrub scrub areas where there's low growing vegetation. Females will use these open sandy areas to nest. So without a wide variety of habitats that these things need to complete different stages within their seasonal movement patterns and for feeding and reproduction, you're not going to completely preserve the species.
And wood turtles are a really perfect example of this. This is wood turtles are actually called wood turtles because their shell actually has an appearance almost of quarter-sawn oak. They don't actually spend all their time in the woods. They're actually a turtle that requires very clean water, gravel-bottom streams. Think of a trout stream. They hibernate there, then they will migrate into fields, and then they will often migrate into woodlands and back into fields. So they're covering these distances. A female wood turtle in this area of the country has to last over a decade before she lays her first egg.
Wow.
So think of everything that that turtle has to live through, crossing roads, fishermen. She's in a field that suddenly they mow. Agricultural mowing is a major problem. It's frankly a miracle that we have any of these animals left.
Absolutely.
If you have questions, 860-275-7266. Let's see. We've got a question from Tim here. Tim's on a cell phone. Go ahead, Tim. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, how are you? My wife is an avid turtle, catcher. She's been catching turtles for like 35 years by hand. And we do go to the lakes in Connecticut, painted turtles, mud turtles, snapping turtles. I guess my question is how do you measure the decline of the turtle population? I've seen turtles myself as big as 35, 40 pounds that my wife has actually caught. So I guess the question is how do you measure that?
Hey, Tim, can I ask you, when she catches the turtles, what does she do with them?
Our kids are very small. We used to take, like, nail polish and write the kids' names on the back of their shell and then release them. It was kind of a thing to do when the kids were 2 and 3 years old in a kayak, and that's about it. And she just loves turtles.
Tim,
she catches them and looks at them and puts them back in the water.
Tim, thank you very much for your phone call. I didn't know that that was the thing. I was looking across at our turtle conservationists here. So is Tim's turtle-catching idea a good one?
I advise primarily for people not to catch turtles, especially if they're not going to not to bring them back to their homes. I mean, of course, you got to get out into the wild and enjoy the natural organisms that we have here in Connecticut to appreciate them. I got to say, Tim, I've never seen one of your turtles with the names on them, though. I'm looking forward to maybe catching one of those in the future. But the way that we measure the declines of turtles, we tend to measure it on an individual basis. So when we're looking at a different species, we'll take it species by species. It sounds to me that the two species that your wife's primarily catching, which are the snapping turtle and the painted turtle, happen to be two of the most common species here in Connecticut. So when we're looking at some of our more species that are less common, like spotted turtles, box turtles, and wood turtles, you know, they have more specific habitat requirements. They're not quite as generalistic as a lot of these more common species are. So the snapping turtles are actually fairly common here in Connecticut right now.
Chuck, how would you suggest someone who loves turtles interact with them in the wild?
Best thing, although it's very hard to resist, is try not to pick them up. But I confess that if I'm in the woods and I see a turtle, I do pick it up and say hi. The most important thing about interacting with them is don't say, I'm just going to bring it home for a few days. because that is where trouble lies. And that's a huge challenge. There's something that we call incidental take, and that's just the idea that it's not coordinated poaching of these animals, which is a huge problem, poaching for the illegal pet trade. But it's walking through the woods with your child and having a turtle and picking it up and taking it home. You can't pick up a cardinal and take it home because the cardinal flies away. Turtles are so easy to catch, and we have so many of these animals sitting in fish tanks at home. And you've got to remember, as far as nature's concerned, that animal is dead. It is no longer contributing to the population.
We got a tweet that asks, what would the average lifespan of the turtle be as a pet for children? Do we suggest
about 2 weeks?
About two. Well, now, Chuck, really?
Yeah. Pet turtles is something which is always a difficult thing for Dennis and I to talk about. And I know that you're never going to convince your child that you don't want a pet turtle. The kid wants a pet turtle. If you do, do not buy a turtle. Go to something like petfinder.com, where you will find not dozens, not hundreds, but thousands of red-eared sliders up for adoption, which is the turtle, that little green turtle that some of us remember was in the plastic tub with the green palm tree. Adopt a turtle. Find out how to take care of it. Do not take turtles from the wild. And if you want a turtle, adopt one.
Dennis, can you add to that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a long-term commitment. You're not talking like Chuck was joking about 2 weeks. You're really talking about 20, 30-year commitment. So this is one of the reasons why when we have these red-eared sliders, when people buy them as small little juveniles in pet stores, they get tired of them and then they release them back into the wild. And one of the problems that we have here in Connecticut is that there's evidence now that red-eared sliders, a non-native species to Connecticut, are now reproducing successfully here, and they outcompete our native species. So they compete for habitat, they compete for food, and they also have a very high reproductive output compared to many other species of turtles. So it's one of those species that we're starting to become more and more concerned about here in Connecticut and the potential impacts it can have on our native turtle populations.
So if you get sick of that turtle that you bought at the pet store and you take it out to the wild and say, run free, little turtle, it's not so much that it will die soon, it's that it will probably reproduce and cause havoc for the rest of the population.
Absolutely. Indeed. In the case of the red-eared slider, it will survive. In the case of many other species, you're actually not doing a good thing by releasing it. It's actually a slow death for the species because it can't adapt to our climate and our habitat here in Connecticut.
It's a little bit of turtle talk today on Where We Live, our own Science Fridays. We talked to Dennis Quinn, an environmental ecologist, and Chuck Landry, who runs the Turtle Conservation Project. We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. We're going to meet some newly emerged painted turtle hatchlings in just a moment, but we want to take some more of your phone calls. I do want to get quickly to the other thing that our tweeter asked about. If indeed you do have pet turtles, or even if you handle them, we hear about bacteria that's on turtle shells, and that's something that's probably not so good to have in your hands, right?
No, you don't want salmonella on your hands and in your mouth. I mean, that's the primary bacteria that you need to be worried about when handling these turtles. And that comes with, you know, all species, basically, but especially these aquatic species. So if you're going to be keeping aquatic species, you absolutely need to maintain completely sanitary conditions for that species to live in.
Well, one of the things I heard a long time ago was a reason not to get a child a pet turtle, a very cute pet turtle, is because the first thing they'll do is put that turtle in their mouth, and that will cause problems.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And in fact, the reason that you no longer in pet stores see dozens of those quarter-sized, bright green, red-eared sliders is because in the 80s, they made it illegal because several children, doing what children do, put those turtles in their mouth, got salmonella, and actually died. If you have young children, you probably do not want a turtle.
Okay, so we're learning things every day here. Let's go to Kira in Danielson. Hi, Kira. Go ahead.
Hi. I just thought some of the misconceptions about turtles are important, even from the perspective of someone who knows enough about nature and animals. I found a turtle that had been hit in a road, and I always thought once the shell was broken, they were goners, but I brought him in to the vet, and first of all, not only was he completely fixable, he wasn't that badly hit, but his shell was broken, he was bleeding. And they also emphasized that it was really important where he came from, very specifically, because when they finished rehabilitating him, they re-released him exactly in that spot. And later I read an essay by Julie Zickfuss, I may be mispronouncing that, in Letters from Eden, how turtles will wander for years if they're not in their home. Like, they don't know how to go back. So I may be sort of getting that a little wrong.
Well, let's try to find out, Karen. Thank you for the question. So I guess the first question is, we find an injured turtle on the road. She took it to the vet. The vet was able to fix up the turtle. Well, I don't know. Is that the, first of all, is that the normal thing to do? Is that what we should do?
You're welcome to do that, yes. And many times, you know, turtles are a very resilient species. I mean, it's not uncommon to find turtles with extensive shell damage, missing limbs even. One of the things when we're talking about females, I mean, missing a back limb becomes a problem because she can no longer nest typically in those sorts of situations. But it's very common to find turtles that have, you know, extensive damage on their shells, missing limbs, and they do just fine. I even know of a turtle in Connecticut that has been blind for the past 10 years, and it gets around the habitat just fine.
So what about placing them back exactly where they came from? You don't want turtles wandering the wild, do you, Chuck?
Well, no, you don't. And of course, the answer to that is, well, you shouldn't have taken it unless it was injured from that place in the first time. But yes, certainly with any animal, you should put it back where you found it. I'll give a shout out to the Tufts University Wildlife Clinic, which is not that far away. And if you do have a badly injured turtle, they do amazing work with reptiles there. Actually, though, especially in my own experience, box turtles do have quite an amazing homing ability. And I'm sure that Dennis and I can trade stories on turtles that wander very long distances and then end up exactly back where they were that time next year. So we're still learning so many things about these animals.
Let's go to Peter in Winchester. Hi, Peter.
How you doing?
Good.
That's what I was just calling about is I live up in Winchester, up next to Winchester Center, and for the last 15 years, the same turtle comes back and lays eggs in the exact same spot every year for the last 15 years. And the nearest water is about a half a mile away. So it comes back to the same spot every year. In the last couple of years, one of the little ones have come back to the exact same spot for the last couple of years where the mother laid the eggs. And it's amazing because I live out in the middle of nowhere. And the other thing is that they usually lay the eggs in the springtime, and they bury them. But if they're not really deep enough, by the end of the night, by the end of the next day, the wild animals dig them up. So on a couple of occasions, I've actually caught where they've gone ahead and laid their eggs, and put a box over them, and in the fall they hatch, and then about 30 of them march off in the fall. That's my comment.
Oh, well, first of all, hey, thanks very much for that, Peter. And Chuck, you want to comment on that? We're going to maybe meet these little turtles you have here, but he was talking about turtle eggs that are left exposed and animals can get to them.
Yeah, turtle nest predation is an immense problem. Raccoons have been around, obviously, for thousands of years also, so that's nothing new. Turtles and raccoons together have lived just fine. But with the human population in Connecticut, populations of raccoons, skunks, possums has also dramatically increased. We also have fewer and fewer nesting areas, so these predators are all just concentrating on those. And there are several studies, for example, down at Jamaica Bay near Kennedy Airport, where 100%, not 99, 100% of nests of diamondback terrapins there are destroyed that night by raccoons unless a cage is put over them. Nest protection is one of these things that it's a great thing to do, but there aren't enough bodies out there to do it. And of course, somebody has to make sure they're there 3 months later to take that cage immediately off so when those babies emerge, they don't cook.
So, okay, you've got some little baby turtles
yeah.
here, and they are adorable little guys. They're painted turtles. I can describe that they're maybe a little bit bigger than a quarter, and where'd you get these turtles?
Well, it's weird because turtles are laying their eggs in June and early July, but these guys are emerging now. So how? Well, painted turtles are unique in that the females lay their eggs in June and early July, as I said. The eggs incubate. They're incubated by just the heat of the sun, and so you will have differing times of incubation. But rather than many of our other turtles, say painted turtles or not painted turtles, box turtles, painted turtles just hang out all winter in the nest And they're only a few inches below the surface. So how do they survive freezing? They actually load their blood with lipids and glucose, basically antifreeze. So they will be emerging and actually heading towards the pond around the same time that the females are heading towards that field to lay the next season's eggs.
So these little guys here, they're new hatchlings. How big are they going to get?
Painted turtles, the females will get about 7 inches and the males about 6.
Yeah, about that.
Yeah. And painted turtles, are they one of the turtle species that is a little bit more endangered here in the state?
They're actually, painted turtles are one of the more common species, probably the second most common, to the snapping turtle being the most common.
If you, when you drive by a pond and you see a big pile of dark-shelled turtles jumbled together on a log, they are eastern painted turtles.
And they're called painted turtles because of their coloring, their markings.
Yeah, it's not so much the top of the shell, but if you look at the underside of a painted turtle, the lower edge of the carapace, which is the top shell, have these beautiful red, almost hieroglyphic-looking markings.
These little turtles are swimming around in what looks like a little fast food container filled with what's in here?
You had to say that, John.
What's in here? What is it, seaweed? What is this?
It's sphagnum moss.
Ah, okay. Well, they're having a good old time. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break. When we come back, a lot of people want to join us at 860-275-726 because they have more questions. We'll get a little bit more about turtle conservation and what we can do to protect turtles here in our native habitat. 860-275-7266.
You shall build a turtle fence.
We don't have any turtles.
One mission, we got quite a few. A turtle fence is exactly what you would think it is. A turtle fence keeps turtles from being hit by cars.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, if you watch House of Cards, you might have noticed a main storyline around a bridge idea from Long Island to Connecticut. Crazy, right? Well, here's the thing. It was a real idea. We'll be talking about bridges, highways, malls, big ideas that were on the drawing board but just never got built. That's our conversation on Mondays Where We Live. Today in the program, a little bit of a Science Friday, we're talking about turtles. There's a lot of turtle species right here in Connecticut. Some of them are, well, they're endangered because of all sorts of things, some things that we do and some other things in their habitats. And we're talking with Dennis Quinn, who's an environmental ecologist. He's a herpetologist who works with the DEP, and also naturalist Chuck Landry, who runs the Turtle Conservation Project. He loves turtles. And if you have questions about turtles, 860-275-7266. Let's go to Bob in Newington. Hey there, Bob. Go ahead. Bob, are you there?
Yeah. Yes, I am here.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to mention, there had been a question about how you would estimate the health of a population of a species. And there is an excellent book out there. It's available on Amazon. I've never seen it in a bookstore. It's called Flattened Fauna Revisited, A Field Guide to Common Animals of the Roads, Streets, and Highways. And what it is there's a wildlife biologist, Roger Knutson, and what he does is he has high school students identify the different species they find crushed on the road. Adjacent to wildlife areas, and uses those numbers to estimate the population of wildlife in the adjacent areas.
That's so interesting, and it sounds like maybe the most disturbing book ever, but it's a very interesting idea. Bob, thank you for raising that. Chuck?
Yeah, I love the title. Hate the fact that they're using, I mean, it's wonderful that he's using that as a tool, but this brings us to the fact that unfragmented habitat is the key. And if you fly into Connecticut, you see this just immense forest. And you say, well, we have more forest than ever. And in a way, that's true. But then if you lay over, say, a Google map, you realize that most of Connecticut is just crisscrossed tightly with roads. And as long as that's the case, so for example, down in Old Saybrook, we're trying to save a 1,000-acre parcel of unfragmented habitat known as the preserve. That habitat has box turtles in it, which I have tracked using radio telemetry, and they just can wander and wander and never worry about a single road. If that and other parcels are developed, it doesn't matter how ecologically well it's developed. There are roads, and when roads and turtles meet, turtles lose.
And Dennis, we've heard about this when we've talked about other wildlife species in the state. This idea of unfragmented habitat is something that's so important. And I think Chuck's right. We do have a lot of forest land, but as soon as you break it up, it causes havoc, especially for animals like this.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. It's one of the leading declines to many species here in Connecticut. And although, you know, as Bob brings up this book, Flattened Animals Revisited, that's a very interesting idea. I would almost read into that as saying, you know, they're more or less measuring the decline of a species rather than measuring, you know, how successful a species is being. You know, if a species is getting hit on the road, that's not to shouldn't be used or misconstrued as a way to measure the density of a thriving population. That population is no longer thriving and slowly declining, or at least slowly decreasing in numbers until it levels out to a sustainable way where they can, you know, match the death rate versus the birth rate.
Well, we've been talking a lot about how humans and the way they build or the way they drive have impacted turtles. I want to ask two quick things. How are turtles as indicators of, say, water pollution? We've read for years about frogs, and we see frogs having all sorts of problems, and then we later find out that there's mercury in a pond in northeastern Connecticut because of a power plant not so terribly far away. Are turtles sort of similar in the way that they're able to act as, if you will, canaries in a coal mine when it comes to pollution?
Absolutely. Many reptiles and amphibians actually can act in a very similar fashion. Specifically the turtles, I mean, they're not going to be directly affected so much by the chemicals that are in the waters. They're going to basically assimilate those chemicals into their bodies. So it's not advised that, you know, if there's some practices that where people still do consume turtles, which is not a good practice, especially now in Connecticut, we're seeing a large number of our snapping turtles being harvested for the commercial trade in snapping turtle meat. So that's not a good thing, especially since a lot of those meats are probably highly toxic and polluted.
I'm just going to stop here.
Yeah.
There's a commercial market for snapping turtle meat that has some sort of a source here in Connecticut?
It's primary source in the Northeast because all the surrounding states, New York, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, all have regulations against the commercial, capturing for the trade.
My goodness. Okay, that's something I didn't even know. So anyway, just to get back to that, so they essentially are assimilating these chemicals, meaning that they're going to be toxic like, you know, the fish
like
that live in a river.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. The same thing. You know, you don't want to eat too many fish because, you know, the toxicity levels within those fish. So you got to be careful of that.
Let's go to Brandon and Ledger. A few more questions here before we run low on time on our Turtle Talk segment. Hi, Brandon. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on getting involved. I'm originally from Massachusetts, moved out to Ledger a while back, and I wanted to just kind of track down some people who were doing reptile conservation, and I was directed to a teacher in a school out there in Massachusetts that was using a telemetry to track snapping turtles. I wanted to learn about things like the hibernaculum in the wintertime and all of that stuff, like where they hibernate and their activities during the wintertime. When I moved out to Connecticut, worked over at Foxwoods, and there was another woman over there with their natural resources department that was also doing the same type of research. So what I did when I was back in Mass is I contacted Mass Fish and Wildlife, and they ended up applying for a permit to be able to mark them. I know, as much as you guys were saying, to, you know, leave them be as much as you can. If there are people that want to get involved,
yeah,
I highly suggest to go out and, you know, contact the state.
Well, and let me ask our expert, just because we're running low on time, Brandon, thank you very much. If people want to get involved, and Chuck, you've been doing this for years, how do people get involved in turtle conservation?
Well, I'd say actually indirectly is the best way. And, of course, everyone is so excited. I'm going to protect nests. I'm going to raise baby turtles until they're bigger and release them, a la the whole sea turtle thing. And a lot of biologists feel that these are, in fact, just really feel-good efforts, that it's a halfway technology. If the habitat that these animals is coming from, something's going on that their numbers are decreasing, what is the point of just pumping more animals in that are then going to decrease? The number one thing you can do to help turtles in Connecticut is get on your local land trust board, get on your local town boards, and help preserve the remaining large parcels of open space.
But Dennis, don't we need citizen scientists in some way, whether it's turtles or anything else, to help do counts, to help track, to help make sure that the habitats actually are the right habitats for turtles?
Absolutely. And you know, exactly what Chuck was saying, that is definitely one avenue for the citizen to get involved. But we also, through the DEEP, is that we seek volunteers all the time. I just actually put a call out for volunteers to work on a wood turtle monitoring study. I have calls out now for volunteers to continue working on a genetic study that's being done with the leopard frogs here in Connecticut. And a new thing that's on the horizon would be there's the snake fungal disease, which is there's a fungus that's starting to affect a lot of our snake populations. We're actually accepting volunteers right now to assist in the capture and just not even to capture these snakes, but to alert the DEEP of the presence of these snakes and whether or not they are infected with this fungus. And then I can get involved, come down, do a sample, and we can do the proper analyses to see, you know, the extent and distribution of this fungus across the state.
So we'll put up some information about how people can get involved on our website later.
Absolutely.
WNPR.org. Let's go to Zach. We just got a few minutes left. Zach, go ahead.
Hello. I'm calling to ask if artificial breeding of turtles is would be a bit of a benefit to the local populations. Anecdotally, out on Long Island, the east end of Long Island where I live, there's actually quite a lot of box turtles, at least on my property. I live next to a moderately sized wetland, and on my property, it's a large nesting area. Unfortunately, there's a couple neighborhood dogs who go around and try to eat some of the eggs, so I've gone ahead and on my own property put up a little bit of fencing, just enough so the dogs keep off, but the turtles are able to get their way in. And that's all that I have. I'll take the answer off air.
He was asking about artificial turtle breeding. Would that help, Chuck?
Yeah. What the caller is referring to is something called head starting, and that's also very controversial. You have to understand that any tiny turtle like the guys that we have here that are about the size of a quarter, I mean, they're just a taco chip to just about everything out there. So the idea is that you protect the nest, and then you raise the hatchlings perhaps for 1 or 2 years until they're a bit larger, a bit more resistant to being eaten by everything out there. There are a lot of questions about, does that change the animal's behavior? Are there dangers of disease transfer? It is something which has been used in some success in some areas, but a great way to start a bar fight is to get two herpetologists talking about head starting.
And they're here today.
Yeah, I've never really been in a bar in which two herpetologists were about to start a fight, but it would be interesting. Robert's in Chester. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just have a question about a box turtle that my wife and I found last year. We found him in Hubbard Park, and he was in one of the brownstone pools that are in the first part of Hubbard Park. And they're about a foot high. They're usually filled with water with fountains and stuff. And we thought it odd that a box turtle would be in a pool. I know they don't live in water. So we took it out. It wasn't afraid of us at all. We ended up bringing it to a vet tech who said that it was definitely a pet that had been released. I just wanted to sort of confirm that we did the right thing with this turtle. I know you shouldn't take it away from its habitat, but it wasn't a normal habitat.
Well, and we've got maybe short time for an answer here. What do you think, Dennis?
I always stick to the general rule of don't touch them. You never really can tell. Even sometimes experts may have a difficulty understanding exactly where these things should be. Box turtles are a terrestrial species here in Connecticut, but do have aquatic tendencies. So seeing them in wetlands and ponds during the hot summer months to cool off and rehydrate is not unusual.
We have another caller who has a question. I can't get to it, but she wants to know, if you have a pet turtle, what do you feed it?
Well, it all entirely depends on the pet turtle, and this all comes down to education. Number one, find out exactly what kind of turtle that is and don't necessarily trust what the pet store said. Do your research. There are a lot of resources online. And also, if you're really interested in helping Connecticut turtles, first and foremost, learn what those species are.
Exactly.
Very important. What's a good place to go to learn what those species are? I mean, a really good one-stop resource.
You can go right onto the DEEP's webpage, Google, you know, turtles in Connecticut, reptiles in Connecticut, and they'll take you right to resources for that.
Is a turtle and a tortoise the same thing, Chuck?
It's basically strictly a cultural, vernacular, linguistic thing. For example, Thoreau in Waldron refers to the box tortoise because he was speaking of a more English English. So scientifically, there tortoises obviously tend to be more terrestrial, but don't worry about that.
Okay. We won't worry about the differences between turtles and terrapins and tortoises, but we will say thanks to our guests who gave us a lot of information today. Chuck Landry from the Turtle Conservation Project, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Dennis Quinn, an environmental ecologist, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can post your pictures and thoughts at WNPR.org. Thanks to Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown, who produce our program. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Thanks very much to Barry the Turtle for his help in producing today's program. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.